So you're saying one click AI generated content is not the loophole that a lot of people thought it was.
It can work short term, crazily good. It's not a good long term strategy.
This is the last time that we will talk about Perplexity in this format here. But basically the winner, you said Grok, but probably also Gemini, right?
I think the question is Gemini going to take the spot of OpenAI?
Now that's what I call a rabbit hole that we just went into.
Sorry about that.
No, love it. That's why we do this format. Before we dive in, you're listening to the Masters of Search podcast with me, your host, Niklas Buschner. Each week, I sit down with some of the smartest people around the world in SEO and AI search to bring you their strategies, mental models, and top pieces of actionable advice. If you enjoy this podcast, don't forget to like and subscribe and follow it in your favorite podcasting app or YouTube. It helps us get top-notch guests and create the best possible content for you. Let's dive into today's episode. Claude Cowork is replacing agencies. A Mac Mini is the new must-have for AI enthusiasts. And Bing just gave marketers something Google still hasn't. A lot has happened in the last few weeks, so it's time for a new episode of Monthly Landwehr. My guest again is Malte Landwehr, CPO and CMO at Peak AI, one of the leading AI search analytics platforms. Malte is one of the brightest minds in the field, so I want to take all the news, new research, and interesting developments and get his perspective on them. Good to have you on again, Malte.
Happy to be here.
Nice. What was your highlight in the last 4 weeks?
My what?
Your highlight. What was the your thing highlight that excited you the most?
A couple of X and LinkedIn posts from Lily Ray and Glenn Gabe talking about AI content generation at scale, where they said a lot of things that I have also said before or thought before and shared them with, I think, 20 examples of SEOs or GEOs who thought that they click a button in a tool and then publish a lot of content and then it works. And I think it was Glenn who coined this term of mount AI, where your visibility increases and then decreases and then it looks like a mountain. And of course, once that happens, once you don't rank anymore in Google, you are also not showing up in the grounding process of any LLM-based answer engine. And that more examples for that have been shared. People are becoming more aware. That was my highlight. Also, a lot of people wrote on X like, hey, I've been using certain tool. I'm not naming them here. And my visibility tanked. And then they also showed their internal, like their Google Search Console screenshots. And then other people replied, hey, I used the same tool. The same thing happened to me. So I really hope that people now wake up a little bit and see that some of these shortcuts are only temporary measures.
Okay, so you're saying one click AI generated content is not the loophole that a lot of people thought it was.
It can work short term, crazily good. It's not a good long term strategy, yeah. And okay. Of course, a lot of other things happened, but that one is my personal highlight.
Okay, do you remember the SEO heist from Jake Ward?
Yeah, I mean, he was one of the first ones to do this, right? Like create semi-content at scale that has on paper potentially good quality if you do a checklist, but actually adds nothing to the internet, has zero information gain contribution. And that's exactly the kind of content Google doesn't need. Google doesn't want to index. And if it's not in the search engines, it's not going to end up in the LLMs. So, yeah, I mean, he was like the first one who very publicly did this, I believe.
I just recently talked to Steve Toth from Notebook Agency. He also runs the SEO Notebook newsletter and the AI Notebook newsletter. And I also talked to him about the SEO heist. And he said, and I think there's a lot of reason to believe him, that Google wanted to set an example when they basically completely de-indexed the causal app website, which was basically the website where Jake Ward put on all the content. And finally, he added that, as you also said yourself, if you look at the content from a checklist perspective, it was okay, but actually the Excel formulas, etc., they didn't really work. So it's like it looks like content, but like the whole depth is completely missing. So Yeah, I don't know. Hopefully people will take this as a wake-up call not to engage in these short-term measures. Something we talked about last time was perplexity basically being left behind. How do you think did your basically prediction there, did it age well?
Yes. I mean, just today when I scrolled through my X feed, I saw a post from someone, hey, remember Perplexity? What happened to them? And also I'm preparing for a couple of conferences right now. So I looked at market share data, and Perplexity is the biggest loser among the big search engines and big LLMs. And just in October, they were bigger than Grok. And now Grok is 50% bigger than Perplexity. Also Claude, who are, I would say, primarily used via the API, based on just website traffic, they are now bigger than Perplexity. So they are really being left behind. I don't understand why people even talk about them anymore. I think they are not relevant.
Okay.
They're good storytellers still.
This was the nail in the coffin for Perplexity. This is the last time that we will talk about Perplexity in this format here. But basically, the winner, you said Grok, but probably also Gemini, right? Taking the spot of Perplexity. Yes. In some way.
Yes. Gemini, I mean, I think the question is even, is Gemini going to take the spot of OpenAI? Because if you look at just monthly active users, they are catching up like crazy. If you look at the actual usage, ChatGPT is still very far ahead, more than twice the size of Gemini, as far as we can estimate usage on the web. Of course, there's a lot of hidden Gemini usage directly in Google Sheets, etc. But the same can be true for OpenAI via various APIs. So it's kind of difficult to understand the total market share. But as a consumer product, yes, they are catching up like crazy. And the product is really good. Like right now, Gemini is in a very good spot, I believe. The UI, I believe, is still significantly worse than ChatGPT. Maybe that's just because I'm so used to ChatGPT, but I've also heard and seen it from others, like how you can manage your chats, find chats, etc. is all a bit less well-rounded, I would say, in Gemini still. But these are things where Google is actually good at, and they should be able to easily catch up if they prioritize it.
I'm not sure if you can share something about it, but maybe just a tendency. What do you see people being most interested in terms of tracking? For example, like also on the Peak AI platform, which models or like which chatbots people want to track their visibility on? Is Perplexity there still super relevant, or has it also shifted towards Gemini, for example?
So we had Perplexity as a default selection when we started, and a lot of people want consistent tracking to do year-over-year comparison, etc. So it's still very big for us. And then since it was a default selection, there was nobody talking about, hey, I want it, right? Because you just got it. I believe that the demand from customers basically mirrors what we just talked about. So there's more interest in Gemini than there was a year ago. There is a lot more interest in Grok than there was a year ago. That is, I think, the big shift.
Nice. I think you also recently launched Copilot, right, as a model that you can track, because I remember we were talking to a client of ours, and they basically gave us the insight that a lot of their customers told them they use Copilot, and so we were obviously eager to also monitor the visibility there. Is this something that you see more people also being interested, like basically, let's say, target group specific models and tools?
Yes. So companies that sell to large enterprises, they want Copilot, which is why we added it.
Nice.
And the reason is, of course, if you work in a very large enterprise, Copilot might be the only LLM that you have access to and the only LLM that you are allowed to use. So you use it to make your purchasing decisions, to research software, to research agencies. So anybody selling to these large enterprises should care about Copilot. In terms of market share, I think Copilot is actually smaller than Perplexity. But Copilot is also very hard to measure in terms of market share, because whenever Microsoft 365 Copilot, formerly known as Microsoft Office 365, formerly known as Microsoft Office. Whenever they do a rebranding, also Copilot is suddenly available under a different subdomain. So it's kind of difficult to keep track on where are all the places where I can access Copilot. But yeah, in terms of total market share, I think Copilot is still pretty small. I know also almost nobody uses it like privately as a consumer LLM, but there are people who do it.
Do you think they do this on purpose to like make it hard for people to assess the market share, or is it just something
No, they just don't care. And when there's a redesign, it's brand driven and they want stuff under a certain domain. And if that is called Bing Edge Service.office.com or copilot.microsoft.com or copilot.office.com or copilot.business.office.com, etc. Like, they don't care. They just do it and make my life more difficult when I try to measure the traffic and attribute it.
Okay. Please stop doing this, Microsoft. Please don't cause more headache for Malta. But speaking of Microsoft, Copilot, etc., there was another thing that was, I would say, somehow big on LinkedIn and also like in the whole AI search space, considering Bing Webmaster Tools and something they introduced there. Maybe you can enlighten people a little bit that haven't been aware of the announcement.
Yeah, so Bing launched a feature where you can see URLs that were used for grounding and you can see fanout queries. I'm personally not a huge fan of the product for a big variety of reasons. But it seems to be important to a lot of SEOs. I'm a little bit shocked that I think many SEOs have just never looked at fanout queries at scale. Like, there was no need to wait for Microsoft Bing. You could have at any time looked in the JSON files that your browser is loading from ChatGPT. There are plugins for it. There are tools that extract these, like PKI, for example. And they are the real fanout queries from ChatGPT, which are actually relevant and interesting. Bing does not clearly communicate what they show in the Bing Webmaster Tools. My assumption is it's Microsoft Copilot, Yahoo Scout, which is an LLM chatbot that is officially based on Bing for grounding. And there are probably a couple of other official partners. There are maybe some queries from OpenAI in there if they are still using Bing, which I believe is unclear at the moment. Like, what is clear is they are using Google. That is known and has been proven again and again and again. Do they also still use Bing? I personally have no idea as of today. So maybe there are some in there. But if you look at how the relationship between Microsoft and OpenAI has developed, I kind of doubt that they use an official API. I think if they were to use it, they would just do scraping like they do with Google. And then Bing has no way of knowing that these are grounded, that these are like fanout queries used for grounding, and has no mechanic to report on them. So I would assume it's just Copilot and Scout. But this is the problem with the data. It's not known. It's unclear. And anybody who ever really cared about Google Search Console data knows how much time you need to invest to actually understand, for example, the difference between the URL and the keyword level data. And I have noticed that even super experienced SEOs often have no idea what the numbers mean, because they don't think about what happens if two URLs from your website show up for the same search term. What happens if the same URL shows up twice, because it can be in different SERP elements? How is the ranking calculated for certain carousels? There are many, many things where people are unaware of what they are looking at in Google Search Console. And this is after people have written hundreds of blog articles, whole books about Google Search Console, and still the vast majority of SEOs can't properly explain the data, especially not what happens once you start filtering, and what happens once you start exporting the raw data and then putting it together again on your own. So I think it's interesting what Microsoft is doing there. I personally don't find it particularly actionable, because I have had access to the ChatGPT fanout queries for a while now. But it's definitely good that more people are getting educated that, you can find out what URLs are used for grounding, or you can understand what fanout queries exist. Like, this is good education, but in the end, you need different data sources, better data sources than the Bing Webmaster Tools.
All right. There's a lot to unwrap here. So first of all, I can 100% confirm I myself spent a lot of time understanding the different dimensions. I remember setting up Looker Studio dashboards and then thinking about what is the difference between the URL dimension and the keyword level dimension with the data from Google Search Console. So let's assume that not everybody listening here has figured this out. So can you explain very simply what is the difference between these two types of data before we go into the Bing topic again and the fanout queries topic again, because there is a lot more obviously here to dig deeper into.
Yeah, so the most important thing I believe is that the URL level data is normalized per URL, per search, per impression. So meaning that if you sum up all your URLs, you will count certain searches twice. And then with site links, for example, might actually be counting the same search 8 times. But then on the other hand, the URL level data is complete. Like, you should have every single impression of your website in the URL level data, while the keyword level data is not complete. Some people call it sampled. I believe sampled is wrong because it's not sampling. It is not 100% documented, or it's actually not documented at all what is happening. Based on some things that Google employees have said to some of their business partners, et cetera, it looks like there's a minimum threshold how often a keyword has to be searched per month until it is reported. It doesn't even matter. You have to show up there 5 times, because 5 or 6 was, I think, back in the day, the minimum amount. So you can see keywords where you only had 1 impression, but very, very surely these keywords had other impressions for other websites to reach a minimum threshold. And when I was at Idealo, we even had cases where on one day, supposedly, we didn't have any impressions for the keyword iPhone 15. Maybe that happened. Maybe we didn't rank for a whole day, but we should have seen that in the traffic pattern. So it's very likely that there was an issue on Google's side where for that one day they classified iPhone 15 as a keyword where people were not seeing data in Google Search Console, which is ridiculous. There are potentially also keywords with higher search volume where something looks like a credit card number or a password, where Google might also decide not to show it. And then, of course, some people might say maybe it's not all about privacy. Maybe also Google wants to take away data from people. So maybe they just have rules that are very likely to not show certain keywords. And then there are things like you have a slider on position 1 that has, 5 elements. All of these are position 1. All of them are counted as position 1. And this is especially annoying if you are in the European Union and you are in one of these DMA compliance mechanisms. So, for example, above Google Maps, you sometimes have these little bubbles of Facebook, Idealo. Those are also counted as position 1 impressions. They have a click-through rate of 0.0001% or something like that, but they mess up your position 1 CTR if you start filtering. Or then when you have the sidebar on the right on desktop, you actually first count the left sidebar and then the right sidebar. So if you have a link in the knowledge graph, that can be position 16 on the first page. That can also really mess up your reporting. Just for the data foundation. And then when you start filtering, just do simple filters, like all keywords with your brand name and all keywords without your brand name. And those might not even add up to 100%. Then you can export the data. Or you can call it via the API, but in the API, there are empty entries. And sometimes you have a whole page of empty entries, and then on pagination 53, there's another little bit of data coming. You need to find that out. Or you can do lots of searches and filtering on the API to get out more data. In the end, the only thing that really works is doing the export to, I just forgot the name of the Google database that you have access to. BigQuery, exactly, where you can export it. There you can actually get all the data. And then can analyze it. Or there's also the option to get that data directly into Looker Studio. But that actually breaks for large websites, because for very large websites, there's a hard limit and it takes the keywords by number of clicks or number of impressions. So you only get your high traffic keywords, but that is also nowhere documented and you don't see it until you run the analysis and you realize, wait a minute, why is my every clicks rate so good? Why is every keyword a high traffic keyword? So there are a lot of things very difficult about Google Search Console data. And I would always do the export and then do the analysis in BigQuery, at least for a large website. When I was at Idealo, whenever we saw a team member screen sharing or making a screenshot where they have applied a filter in the web interface, it was like almost a meme of somebody in team speaking up. Just a reminder, like whatever you are looking there, it's like kind of random and we can't actually make any interpretation out of it. And it's true for large websites, you need the BigQuery export and then analyze the data there.
Now that's what I call a rabbit hole that we just went into.
Sorry about that.
No, love it. That's why we do this format. But still, even though probably a lot of people should spend more time in Google Search Console, why do you think people are so excited about the Bing Webmaster Tools new feature, new data that's popping up?
Because it has not been accessible for them previously. Like, not everybody has access to fanout queries from ChatGPT. I mean, they could. It's not difficult, but they never bothered or never were given the tools to do it. And now you see fanout queries for the first time. And hey, of course, that's exciting. I would be excited as well. Or they have never looked at which of my URLs are actually being used for grounding, which you could, to a certain degree, estimate based on your log file analysis. Or you could look in the sources in ChatGPT or could use a software like PKI. And if you have never done that, again, seeing these are URLs that were really used for grounding. Like, this is the truth. This actually happened. Bing says so. I think that is exciting. And it's very easy to trust the data. If you have never looked at any GEO, AEO, AI search tools, of course, getting the data from a trusted source like Bing is easy. Like, you know it's correct. I mean, you actually don't know what it is, so it's very easy to say it is correct. But if you don't care very deeply about how data is defined, where it's coming from, what it means, then it's very, very easy to trust Bing, just like it's easy to trust the Google Search Console.
And do you think Google will follow?
I think Google has very few incentives to do so. I believe this is a decision that's made by some regulatory compliance and lobbying team at Google to decide, do we need to offer this to make some stakeholders happy? Based on the current US government, I don't think it is needed, because right now Google is protected from the European Union. It's not possible for the European Union to level any fines against Google, at least not realistically. But in the future, this might change, of course.
Okay. Let's dive a little bit deeper into fanout queries, because you already mentioned it, and I saw that you did some very interesting research on them that is, I would say, particularly relevant, at least that's my interpretation, for non-English markets. So what did you find there?
Yeah, so it wasn't me finding this. All of this research at PKI is done by Tom and Tomek, two of my team members. And in this case, what we found out is that when you write a prompt in German with a German IP address, very, very likely one of your fanout queries is going to be in English. It's usually the second fanout query. And they, of course, then also pull in English-speaking websites as sources. And we tested this for a bunch of different languages. And between 60% and 90% of the time, one of the fanout queries is in English, when the prompt itself was not English. From anecdotal evidence, I think for the e-commerce fanout queries, this value might be even higher. But it's only anecdotal evidence. I haven't analyzed it. And yeah, this is interesting, of course, right? Because it means that even if you are a German-speaking brand that only sells to German-speaking people in Germany, whatever is written about you on the English-speaking internet is relevant. And first of all, let's talk about maybe also why it happens. The honest answer is we don't know. One hypothesis is there is just more English-speaking content on the internet, and it makes sense to do it. And I think for many topics, that's actually true. If I ask in German, I don't know, what's the capital of the United Kingdom? How tall is the Eiffel Tower? These are things where disinformation is more often available in English than in German. Another hypothesis is that English is a very token-efficient language. So if you express something in English, it's generally a lot shorter than the same thing expressed in German or Turkish or Thai or many, many other languages. And this also translates to a lot of token efficiency. And of course, many of the models we are using in Europe, they are trained primarily on English-speaking content by English-speaking data scientists. So even if you prompt in German, sometimes all the reasoning is happening in English. By the way, with the Chinese models, it also sometimes happens that they start reasoning in Chinese when you ask questions, and then it's weird because you look at it and you don't know what's going on anymore. So it's unclear if it's intentional, if it's a side effect of something, but it is happening. And what does it mean for me as a brand? It means I should not be surprised if I see English-speaking sources, and I need to be aware that whatever is written there about me is relevant. And it gives a huge advantage to brands coming from English-speaking countries who are internationalizing, because, like, imagine you have a big footprint in the US and you come to Germany. You have zero footprint, usually. It's an uphill battle. But now in LLMs, If one fanart query is English, you have a huge advantage, actually, because for, let's say, 1/3 of the fanart queries, or 25% or whatever, you are already there because you already have the English-speaking content and you're dominating. So I think it's a huge advantage, especially for US companies, because when we say English-speaking internet, it's the US-centric internet, at least. Huge advantage for them. Huge problem for pure local players. Like somebody like Audi will not suffer because they also have English-speaking content about Audi already. But a pure local brand that is competing with international brands has a disadvantage, because they don't show up in the English fanart queries, most likely, because they don't have content for it.
And would you recommend a pure local player that has only published content in German now to maybe look at the most important pages, whatever this means, like let's say rankings, let's say traffic, let's say conversion impact, whatever we might find meaningful, and then creating basically English versions of those just to make sure you get a better coverage also by these English fanart queries?
I would not check what are my most converting, etc. pages. I would check what kind of pages are being cited in the prompts that I care about. So we actually did another analysis on this that we will publish soon. If you have an informational prompt or a commercial prompt that is not yet transactional, then it's very unlikely that a product page will be cited. So even though you make all your conversions on a product page, you really don't need to translate it to influence these kinds of prompts. So I would go the other way, see what kind of content is being cited and see, should I create something similar to that? I wouldn't say I can recommend this because I would have to test it a couple of times to actually give a good recommendation. But I would consider it. If I was an in-house SEO right now, tasked with AI visibility in the scenario you described, I would think about this and probably run a test. I would also think about, does this content need to live on my own website, or can I just publish it on Medium or on LinkedIn Pulse or on dev.to, or can I just make a profile on a couple of websites? Like, there are many potential scenarios.
Maybe something I can add here just from a very anecdotal experiment we did with a client. We had German content around, let's say, mobile device management, onboarding automation solutions. And we had to, so we didn't do it on purpose to do some like GEO experiment, but we had to create a German and an English version just for the CMS setup. And interestingly, we also tracked it with PKI. For some prompts, actually the German version and the English version was cited. So we basically had double citations. I also did a post on LinkedIn. I think some people said, do you really feel like this is something that is sustainable? I'm not sure, but I found it interesting to see it happen, because I obviously immediately, as SEOs always do, thought about how to exploit this. Then I said, okay, let's keep the users in mind. So is it valuable for the users? Because we have English-speaking target customers and German-speaking target customers. Then I would say, yes, it makes sense from a user perspective. But if you would just do it probably to like trick the final queries, probably not a good idea.
Yeah, I think there are some things you can do that you technically do to trick the fanout queries. Like, I've done that in SEO a lot. Just the important thing is that from the outside, it's not clear you do that. Without naming now a former employer at a company where I once worked, I was running a lot of SEO projects where then also people from the outside told me, hey, are you doing this for SEO? And I was like, I have not really heard of that project. I think our sales team is doing it, or it's something from the social media team or the content team or whatever. But in reality, it was like pure SEO project, just so well hidden that even SEOs from the outside were like thinking, I'm not sure it's an SEO thing they are doing there. Maybe it is. So I think it's totally fine to create pages just to influence the fanout queries. Just it has to look like that's not the case. And even when someone looks very deeply, it cannot look like that. Like a very experienced SEO, they can have a doubt in their head. But if you look at it, Niklas, and you know it's an SEO thing, then it's not good enough. It has to be so good that you are asking yourself, this could be done for SEO, but I'm not entirely sure. Like, for example, if it's if the Excel formulas that are shown there are not working, then it's not good enough, right? It has to be really top-notch, perfect. So if it's an English-speaking website, maybe also put a video interview with the CEO in English, that even if a Google quality rater goes on the website, they should be like convinced, yeah, this is a legitimate English-speaking version of their website. When your competitor looks at it, they should not be like, oh, I report this to Google, it's spam. They should be like, why do they have an English-speaking version? When a journalist who hates you looks at the website, they should not be able to find anything sketchy about it. That is how good you have to hide your SEO measures, in my opinion, on very, very large websites where most of my SEO experience is. But I wouldn't say you can't do it just to influence, like just do it. I've done so many things around cloaking, adding content, hiding content that I in the end did just for SEO. That sometimes also turned out influencing conversion rate and stuff like that. But yeah, I think it's sometimes okay to do things just for SEO. Just they can't be negative for this experience and people from the outside cannot notice.
Okay, if at some point you will write your memoirs or like your biography, I would suggest maybe Life of an SEO, just maybe an idea for the title. I hope that you will share some of the behind the scenes from these experiments that you did, because you, at least from me, you created an insane FOMO now to learn more about this.
As long as any of my customers or former employers exist, I will take these secrets with me. If some companies cease to exist at some point, maybe I can talk about things. But I will never write my memoirs. Never, ever. There's no scenario where I would do that.
Okay, now, insane bridge. Maybe you should let Claude Cowork or OpenClaw write your memoirs. I want to have a little clap sound effect now introduced here. No, just kidding. In the last 2 weeks or last, no, I think it's not 2 weeks. Like in the last, I would say 4 to 6 weeks, at least for not the AI nerds on X. I think most of the listeners here are not on X all the time. There are two new kids on the block. One is Claude Cowork and one is OpenClaw. Have you tried both yet?
I have not. I wish, like I have this itching in my fingers to buy another MacBook and to create a new virtual credit card and to just install OpenClaw and give it access to this credit card. But I currently work 70 hours a week on Peak AI and I have zero time for distractions. So no, I'm not working on them. I have some coworkers looking into both. At some point, somebody will sit me down and tell me, Malte, I know you're almost 40 now, but you need to change how you work and give me a quick introduction. But right now, I just lack the time for it, unfortunately. But I would love to.
And do you use something else, like not Claude Cowork, but then maybe Gemini or OpenAI, whatever, for like your own daily AI companion or AI driver?
Yes, like my main tool is ChatGPT just because it works well for my private and business use cases. I have more and more business use cases that I move to Gemini because it's sometimes just better. And I use Manus a lot. Okay. I think this month alone, I upgraded my Manus account 5 times because it's really powerful for complex multi-step tasks.
Okay. Can you share one example for people to have a better like visual imagination of it?
I mean, very complex research, for example, where you need to sift through, 500 documents, and only the first 5 documents will then tell you what are the next. This is something where already Gemini is so much better than OpenAI, deep research. But then something else for Manus is if you don't have the biggest subscription to SimilarWeb, then the Manus skill for SimilarWeb actually gives you access to a lot of SimilarWeb data. So you can give us 100 domains and say, give me the traffic that these websites had in Germany last month. Or just conduct very, very deep research and then prepare a text or a briefing or something like that.
Okay.
For example, if I had not forgotten about it, I would have given Manus the task to create a briefing for me for this episode. I did it last time. I forgot to do it today.
Yeah, no worries. I mean, this is why I'm here doing the heavy lifting. And again, a reminder for everybody from last episode, if you have positive feedback, please send it to Malte. If you have any negative feedback, send it to me. So Malte keeps being super happy and super engaged into doing this, just as a quick favor you can do me. Now, let's talk about something that has been announced very, very recently on the day that we are recording this year, which is a huge funding round for, I would say, a competitor or maybe just a tool that operates in the similar space as Peak AI, which is Profound. They announced a $96 million Series C at a unicorn valuation. Do you have thoughts on that?
Of course, I have thoughts on it. The question is, what are my thoughts that I can mention publicly?
I always like that you take my question and then turn it into an even better question.
I mean, they are a competitor, of course. Like, they were the first one who started. They always say they started 18 months ago based on the founder's LinkedIn profile. I actually think they started 24 months ago, but not sure. So they have a head start versus everyone else in the space. And they have been very aggressive in terms of the evaluation and raising money. And if you logically think about it, building an AI visibility and AI optimization tool cannot be enough to justify that valuation. Like, nobody invests at a 1 billion evaluation because they hope the value climbs to 2 billion, right? That's not how venture scale investing works. And this was a VC. This was not like a private equity buyout or something who might be happy with the 2x. So if you look at then what they also announced, which is their what they called agents, which to me is a workflow builder, like N8N in a more expensive version. The only reason they can justify that valuation is if they either replace marketing employees or replace agencies or automate significant parts of the marketing stack. I'm not saying they are doing this. Like, I have no knowledge of that. Or if I did, I could not speak about it. But the only thing that logically makes sense to me is that their story is actually a lot more than AI search. And I think they will actually become less of a competitor because of it. I think they need to take on, at that evaluation, probably not even SEMrush is a relevant competitor anymore for them. They need to take on Salesforce Marketing Cloud, Adobe, these kinds of players. Otherwise, the evaluation and the amount of money they raised makes no sense to me. Like, and they have more open, Profound has more open jobs right now than we have total employees. And I believe we are also, based on team size, the second largest in the space. Their marketing team is, I think, 8 people they communicated today. We built our product with less than 8 people in the whole company, and that includes interns. Like when I joined, there were less than 8 people. Or when I signed, there were less than 8 people. I think when I joined, there were 8, 9 people. So yeah, very, very, I mean, just also if you compare it to current SEO companies, some of them are probably at a $1 billion evaluation if they were to be in the venture game or if anybody would still invest into them. But the only company that actually reached unicorn status as an SEO tool was SEMrush. And of course, Ahrefs would be there if they were a venture-funded business. And probably 7, 8, 9 years ago, BrightEdge was there. I don't think BrightEdge is a unicorn nowadays, because where's the growth? I also don't think any of the other players in the space are at unicorn status. So yeah, it's a crazy high evaluation. But it shows how bullish people are on the space, how much change people expect to happen in the organic marketing space.
And do you think, because there was a comment on LinkedIn that I read today about the funding announcement that I found interesting, where someone said, I think this, so I'm quoting or paraphrasing, I think this will help create more trust in the whole AI search industry. Do you also think that this is something where you can see a connection of like these big funding rounds creating more trust?
Among enterprise buyers, yes. Among very small companies, I'm not sure. I think there might even be a bit of a negative reaction to so much VC funding, yada, 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 especially in Germany. Less so in the US, where people are much more open about VC funding and have more understanding that it's the only way to build a software company in a competitive space nowadays. But in Germany, I'm not sure that it actually leads to more trust. Also, we don't know what Profound will do with that money. And without any judgment, Profound is the only company I know that has repeatedly deleted the research that they previously published from their own website. It is up to anybody to interpret what that means. But it's not something that we have ever done. It's not something I see Systrix or SEMrush or Ahrefs doing, but Profound has done it with multiple of their research articles after they have been cited by everyone on LinkedIn.
I feel like the part you're stressing about the research, I also noticed that a couple of companies, not naming any names, but definitely not PKI, were on this one, I want to be very clear, they did research, but I feel like it was just marketing narrative with a sprinkle of some data analysis and a sprinkle of some here and there, and it was just labeled as research just to push the narrative, right? It's something that has become way more popular over the last years.
Yes, I'm also seeing it a lot, especially from US-based competitors of ours, doing sometimes an analysis on something like 10,000 chats, which is like anecdotal evidence, I would say. Like, you could have an intern label 10,000 chats. Like, it's not at any way deep, relevant data. And we usually try to run our analysis on significant larger amounts of data. But even then, it's always a challenge to normalize the data, make sure it's actually representative, because we don't have prompt volume. We don't have 100% representative real user prompts, right? Like there are all these challenges in the GEO space. And I think when you do research, you need to acknowledge that. There are players who might decide to ignore it and just publish anyways and say, this is how it is.
Mm. Malte, it has been insanely insightful again. Thanks so much for taking the time. Already very much looking forward to the next episode. For people listening or watching, if you have any questions or anything, please put it in the comments somewhere, no matter where, YouTube, your LinkedIn comments. I think podcasting apps, you can't comment. If you have positive feedback, send it to Malte. If you have negative feedback, send it to me. Other than that, Malte, already very much looking forward to the next one.
Likewise. And you should probably tell people who have positive feedback to give you a rating on Spotify or something.
Yeah, I added a prequel that will go before our talk where I have the call to action. God, I'm in marketing for 13 years and now I can't come up with the word call to action. I have a call to action to like, subscribe, leave a comment, blah, blah, blah. So, but very, very kind of you to think about that. So, yeah. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
You.
Bye-bye.